Now, we're going to dive straight in with our study on Acts 19. And this is the last one, I think, unless something else occurs to me in the week. I think this is the last one in this series we've been doing. There was a long break at the start of the lockdown, but we were doing it up until the lockdown, and we picked it up 3 weeks ago, I think. Now, there's going to be a series of slides, so if we can throw those up, and we can begin to see what's been going on. And now the passage we've been looking at is Acts 19, and we had Marcos read us the end of that chapter. But the subject we've been looking at is the spiritual battle. So we've been seeing how, as Paul took the gospel to Ephesus, there was a great spiritual battle. Ephesus was Satan's stronghold. And Paul was taking the gospel, and this great battle unfolded. And so we've been approaching this chapter really asking the question, well, what is the spiritual battle, and how does it look, and how do you wage it? So we've seen how Satan wages war. We've also been seeing how God wages war. Now, we're going to stop now and again to take any questions through the evening. And that number up on the screen is my phone number. So if anybody wants to WhatsApp me a question, I'm thinking particularly of those who are watching on the live stream, that'll come to Abby over here. She got my phone. And if we get any questions like that, she'll shout them out. And they can go into the mix with any questions that we have actually here. So that's the plan. Now, as I said, we're looking at Acts 19, and we've been thinking about how God wages war. And we've seen that he wages war through his Son. We've seen he wages war through his Spirit. We've seen he wages war through his Word. And then last time we saw that God wages war through his people. Now, one last one is what we'll think about tonight. And that is that God wages war, actually, in some senses, through all people. Now, let's think this through, and hopefully by the end, you'll see what I mean. Now, let's go to Acts 19. Now, if you haven't got a Bible, the text will be on the screen, most of it. We've had to put away the church Bibles. We're not allowed to give anything out. So if you want to be bringing your own Bible in the future, that would be a good idea. But most of it's on the screen, so you can follow it there. So go to Acts 19 and that section that Marcos read to us. And what I want you to see is that there is a dangerous situation developing. Now, the first part of that chapter has been the story of great gospel success. You know, Paul has gone to the place, he's preached the gospel, there have been great miracles, and many, many people have been converted. There's been a great victory. But what happens in the second half of the chapter is Satan begins a bit of a fight back. So there is a dangerous situation developing. It starts with this man, Demetrius. Now, Demetrius is from Ephesus, and he was making a lot of money out of the pagan religion that was practiced there. And he sees that so many people are becoming Christians that people are no longer buying what he was producing, silver shrines for the worship of Artemis. And so he begins to raise a crowd. He begins to raise a rabble. He gets together, first of all the workmen who work in the same trade as him. And he starts to remind them that they're losing money. And that's always a great motive, isn't it? If you're losing money, then you start to worry. Well, certainly, that's the string that Demetrius pulls here. And not only that, he says, but people are turning away from the worship of our goddess, the worship of Artemis. So we've got real problems here. And the way he summarizes at the end of that section, he says, huge numbers are being led astray. And they're turning away from the worship of Diana. And so, he goes on, there's a danger. Not only that our trade will lose its good name, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis will be discredited. And the goddess herself, who is worshipped throughout the province of Asia and the world, will be robbed of a divine majesty. Now, when we talked about this, we saw that behind the scenes here, we have Satan pulling the strings. He's pulling Demetrius's strings, his desires, his greed for money, and the other tradesmen. We also saw how Satan is using this pagan religion to stir up a crowd. Well, it works, because what we read here is that a great crowd began to develop. When they heard this, they were furious and began shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" And word spreads. Soon, we're told, the whole city was in an uproar. The people seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions. They all rush as one man into the theater. There's a great crowd, a great rabble, a great riotous assembly. They're shouting. You can see there's a dangerous situation developing. Now, Paul wants to stand before the crowd and speak to them. Tells you the sort of man he was. Everyone's begging him not to. We have other people trying to stop it, but unable to stop it. Now, my point is simply this. There's a threat here, a dangerous situation developing. And what's going to happen? You know, they're rioting against the gospel. It looks like Satan has won a great victory. And the danger's real. You know, God has broken through and established his kingdom. This looks like, well, it looks like the brink of a successful fight back. And nobody can do anything. I've already said, Paul can't stop it. You know, he wants to go to the crowd and people won't let him. The Jews can't stop it. We're told that they pushed Alexander to the front and trying to make a defense before the people. But the crowd's not having any of it. You know, it makes it worse. The crowd shouted in unison for about 2 hours, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." It just feels as if no one is in control. In fact, we're told, verse 32, that the assembly was in confusion. Everyone's shouting. Some were shouting one thing. Some were shouting another. And we're told that most of the people didn't even know why they were there. So do you see the picture we've got? The mob is just in control. Anything could happen. And the focus of their anger is this Christian church and this gospel message. See, a dangerous situation. Now, what happens next is wonderful. God intervenes and he overcomes this great fight back from Satan. He intervenes. Now, here's the question. How does he do it? What mighty force does God use to stop Satan in his tracks? You know, what mighty miracle does God perform to stop this riot? You know, is there lightning from heaven? Is there an earthquake? What great intervention does God give? And really, this is my punchline. It's amazing. God stops Satan, not through some great miracle, not through lightning from heaven. You know, God stops Satan through the unbelieving town clerk just doing his job. Now, do you see how amazing that is? He is a great threat, a genuine threat, a real threat to the kingdom, to the gospel. There's a riot against God's people. Paul can't stop it. Nobody can stop it. It's got a life of its own, a power of its own. God intervenes. But he does it through an unbelieving official who's just doing his job. Now, the story's there. It's a beautiful thing. We are just told, verse 35, that the city clerk turned up. Now, I don't know what you imagine when you hear the word city clerk. I imagine a man in a suit with a clipboard. I don't suppose that was what he looked like. He's obviously a pretty powerful figure, but he's not a believer. There's no indication of that. He's not got an army with him. He's just an official, the city clerk. And he just turns up and he just starts talking sense to the crowd. He quietens them. They know him. They recognize him. And he begins to talk to them. He says, "What are you shouting about? Why are you shouting, 'Great is Artemis of the Ephesians'?" He says, "All the world knows about Artemis and about Ephesus. Nobody's denying that. Why are you making such a row about it?" And then he talks about the fact that they've dragged Paul's companions into the middle of all this. And he says, "Look, what are you doing? You've brought these men here. They haven't robbed temples. They haven't blasphemed our goddess. You know, it's Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen that started this." He says, "If they've got a problem, the courts are open. They can go to law about this. They can there is a legal system. They can use it. They can press charges." And he says, "Is anything else you're worried about? Well, we need to do it in the proper way. It's got to be settled," he says, "in a legal assembly." He says, "As it is," he says, "we are in danger of being charged with rioting because of today's events." Now, every few years in this country, we like a good riot. But if you tried rioting in the Roman world, you found that the Roman army came down on you rather hard. And you might find that from then on there was a big scary garrison breathing down your neck all the time. So you did not want to be charged with rioting by the Romans. Okay, there would be a brutal suppression. So he's flagging up a very real danger that none of them would have wanted to happen. And he goes on to explain, "In this case, we wouldn't be able to account for the commotion. There's no reason for it." And after he said this, this is all that happens. After he said this, he dismissed the assembly. Now, there it is. Great crisis. A Satan fighting back. And God deals with it through the town clerk, through local politics, through the legal system, through the courts. And all this man does is he does his job in a good, developed society. Now, this then is the last thing I want us to talk about. You know, God, he does his waging of war through his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. We've talked about that. God does his waging of war through his Spirit, the Holy Spirit. God does his waging of war through his Word, the sword of the Spirit. God does his waging war through his people, our witness, our prayers. But now we're seeing that in the end, God can use anybody. And he can use the most ordinary of things for his glory and his purposes. Now, what we're talking about here has got a name that over the years theologians have given to it. What we're talking about is called common grace. And I want us to think about this tonight. Common grace. Now, let me explain what I mean. We're seeing it here illustrated. Let me fill it out a little bit, then we'll stop if there's any questions. So common grace, what's that? Well, we know about saving grace, don't we? Saving grace is regeneration, being born again. It is justification, you know, being made right with God. It is sanctification, being made holy like Jesus. It is glorification, you know, the resurrection and going to heaven when you die. And you know, that's saving grace, isn't it? You know, it's the gospel. So we know about saving grace. We're not talking about that here. We've already been talking about that the other ways that God wages war, through his Son, through his Spirit, through his Word. These are all the saving grace things. This is not saving grace, this is common grace. Now, let me explain what that is. So, what we're talking about here, these are gifts of God, so they are grace. They're things God gives, they're things God does, but they don't save anyone. It's not saving grace. God gives them not just to those who are saved, in fact. God gives grace like this to absolutely everyone. That's why it's called common grace. And this common grace is about keeping the world habitable. It's about stopping the world falling down in its rebellion and sinfulness while God saves and transforms and rebuilds. And we're seeing it in Acts 19. We are seeing that in Ephesus, there was a government, a city clerk. Now, the fact there was a city clerk is about common grace. It was God who gave them a government like that. It was God who gave them a city clerk. So that man who stood there, he was part of God's gracious provision to the city of Ephesus, that it had a government, it had officials. He talks about the legal system. Verse 38, he says, the courts are open, they can press charges. Now, that again is an example of God's common grace. He gives a legal system to a country, and that brings some defense and some way of dealing with trouble and difficulty. We've got the rule of law. So in verse 40, he says, we are in danger of being charged with rioting because of today's events. He's appealing to the rule of law. And what I'm saying is that all of those things are good things, and they're all gifts of God, but they're gifts that God gives not just to Christians, not just to the church. He gives them to the world. So they're common to everyone, and not just to his people. And they're about keeping the world habitable. They're about keeping the world going while God saves. There are other examples which are not in Acts 19, but which we could include. Examples of common grace. Art and literature and culture. We could put music in there, single that out too. You know, those are great gifts from God, aren't they? They don't save anybody. You could be a wonderful musician and be a complete dreadful person, but you've had this gift from God to be this wonderful musician. Or you may be a great poet or a wonderful novelist and able to write wonderful things, or a great journalist. And you've got these great gifts, and you write, and people think and understand. But you might not be a Christian. You might be a terrible person. But it's a gift of God, and it's a gift that God has given to make life easier, to make the world a better place, to keep it going. Another example of common grace would be education and science and medicine. It's not just Christians that are educated. In fact, Christians may be not educated at all. It's got nothing to do with whether you're a Christian, how educated you are. Education is a gift of God. And so the fact that we have schools in Grangetown, good schools in Grangetown that people can go to and the children can learn, and they'll learn good things and they'll learn well, and there'll be adults who care about them. Now, that's not saving, is it? That's not about being a Christian and going to heaven. But it is a good gift of God, and God uses it to keep the world going. And so, you know, promoting education is a good thing to do. Science, medicine, we could say the same. I think we could put marriage and family into this category as well. It's not just Christians that get married. It's a creation ordinance. So it's been given to the whole world, and it's to provide stability for the family units. And a safe environment for children to grow up, a stable environment. Marriage is about being committed. So again, it's a gift that strengthens a society. It doesn't save anybody, but it's a gift from God. It's common grace, or even just the level of friendship and community. Good things, good gifts. It's been wonderful, isn't it, to see over the time of lockdown, the community coming together, people willing to help, people willing to go. Now it wasn't just Christians that were doing that. It was all sorts of people. All the different faiths were doing it. Now that's God's common grace given to human society, gifts of friendship, gifts of community. Now you sort of get in the drift of what I'm talking about. We're seeing it in Acts 19. There's plenty of examples all around us. Just God giving good things to all sorts of people that just help keep the world going. Now, here's a quote from our friend Tim Keller. So this is his sort of explanation about it. He says, God gives out good gifts of wisdom, talent, beauty and skill graciously, that is, in a completely unmerited way. He casts these gifts across all humanity, regardless of religious conviction, race, gender, or any other attributes, just to enrich and brighten and preserve the world. Now, it's God's common grace that had produced this city clerk in Ephesus. And we see there in Ephesus God using him to stop Satan. He didn't know he was doing it. But nevertheless, God used him to stop Satan. So that's common grace. And that's what I mean when I say that God can use all people to fight his battles. He can use all people because of common grace. Now, in a minute, I'll see if there's any questions. But let me just show you a few photos first that I hope will bring us all together. First photo. There you are, desirable residence for sale in Grangetown. Needs a little bit of work. No, it's a ruin. No, I don't know where it is. It's not in Grangetown. But once upon a time, that was a very nice house. But it's been ruined. And it's a good picture of our world. You know, once our world was pristine and perfect, but we've ruined it. We've rebelled against God. Our world is fallen. It's ruined. Now, what God is going to do is rebuild our world. That's what the plan of redemption is about. So he sent Jesus into the world. He sent his spirit into the world. He sends his word into the world. He sends his people into the world in order to rebuild the world and to see people redeemed. And one day, the last day, Jesus Christ returns and unveils the finished product, makes all things new. Now, you don't just rebuild a house like that in a day, do you? It takes time. And so what you'd do if you were going to build it, the first thing you're going to do is to stop it falling down even more. So you'd, it's a different house now, I admit. So what you do is you get some scaffolding and you put the scaffolding up around it. Only you wouldn't use scaffolding like that. You'd probably use something like this. Now, that's not scaffolding. That's some great big truss, some enormous strong girders. And what those are doing is stopping the building falling down. So God's plan for the world is to rebuild it. But he uses common grace, the same way these builders are using the scaffolding, the truss. He uses common grace to hold it together, to stop it getting any worse, to stop it falling down even more. And that gives the time and the space to do the redeeming work over the centuries, over time. So those three pictures, I think, are the way to put it all together. You know, there's our ruined house. Oops. I can go back a bit further, can I? Oh, too many. Okay, there's our ruined house. we don't want it to fall down anymore. God's going to rebuild it. So he puts up the scaffolding. He puts up the trusses to stop it falling down. So the trusses are education and science and community and marriage and friendship and government and law and order and the legal system. He uses that as the scaffolding to stop it all falling down. Meanwhile, he is spreading the gospel. He's sending his son. He's sending his spirit. He's sending his word. He's sending his people. So that is sort of the big idea. Okay, I've been promising you questions. Are there anything you want to ask about or talk about? We'll just kill the mic for a minute on the live stream. Okay, so I've gone on about this common grace and law and order and friendship and marriage and stuff. God using that gift that God gives to the whole world to just keep it going. I suppose the next question then is, well, where's that in the Bible? You know, we want to be biblical, don't we? I've used examples from Acts 19, but where's the teaching? Where's the theology behind it? Where's the Bible behind it? Well, the idea of common grace is rooted in creation itself. You know, God is the creator. We forget that sometimes as Christians because we talk a lot about redemption, the gospel, and the rebuilding, and we can easily forget that God is committed to the whole world. It's still his. So this idea of common grace, it's a way of saying that God still cares. He's still committed to creation. He's not only interested in believers. And there's loads of places we could go that speak about that. Psalm 103 would be a classic example. How God gives food, he cares for all that his hand has made. Now, you've been to the beach recently. I hope the weather was better than that. That's a horrendous, grim, grey wave. And I've put it up there because I wanted to remind you of Noah's flood. Now, you remember in Genesis 6, 7, 8, 9, the world has got so wicked that God destroys the world with a great flood. It's like he wipes it clean. And he starts again. He preserves Noah and his family in the ark. And after the flood has receded, all that's left of humanity and the animal kingdom is what is in the ark. And it's as if God's starting again with creation. You know, like when your computer doesn't work and you phone up the helpline and you say, my computer's not working. And they say, okay, turn it off and turn it on. And then you do that and it works. You sort of reboot it and it works. And then they say, £50, please. But that reboot, that's what's going on with the flood and Noah's Ark. You know, the world God created has been in rebellion and it's been getting worse and worse. And it's as if God says, you know what, it's just not going to survive like this. I'm going to turn it off and turn it on. I'm going to reboot the system. I'm going to set it up so now it can run in this fallen state. So in one sense, it's after the flood that this scaffolding is put in place that's holding the ruin up. And actually, we're told that God makes a covenant with Noah and with creation at that time. And there's lots of verses that say it, but this is from chapter 8, verse 21. God saying to Noah afterwards, never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. Later on, it goes to talk about God making a covenant. Now, that's the sort of language God used at creation. He said to Noah to fill the earth, be fruitful and increase. Not Noah, Adam, he said, be fruitful and increase at the very beginning. So now he's rebooting the system and he's, if you like, sending Noah out. He's starting again. But look, he's promising now, I'm never going to destroy the earth again. I'm going to keep it going. There's going to be harvest. There's going to be day and night. And it's been common to talk about this promise, this covenant God made, as the covenant of common grace. That this is the moment where God promises to do these things, to keep the world stable, to give all that's necessary to keep the world together while he redeems, while he saves. Now, you could jump to the New Testament and see some examples of this. Acts 14, Paul is preaching and you see common grace in action. He's preaching to pagans who don't believe at all in Acts 14. And he says this, in the past, God let all nations go their own way. Yet, he has not left himself without testimony. He has shown kindness, see, grace. How? By giving you rain from heaven and crops in their season. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. He's talking about all the sort of good things that people have. And he's saying it's common grace. It's evidence of God's kindness. And in fact, he's saying, it should have made you think about God. It should have made you seek him. Did I put the other one? Oh yeah, Romans 13. Now, Romans 13 is a passage that talks about the government. It says some amazing things. Let me just throw it up. Pardon the expression. Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except that which God has established. You see, this city clerk, he's a gift of God. It's been established by God. And here he's calling people to submit to that, to recognize these authorities. And he's saying to the church, recognize they've been established by God. So he says, if you rebel, you're not just rebelling against the authority, you're rebelling against what God has instituted. So that's why you pay taxes. You know, we should be glad to pay our taxes. Well, because government is God's gift, and we need it, and we should be thankful for it. Now, what's so astonishing about that is that the government he's talking about there is the Roman Empire. With all of the terror and brutality and the severity of its taxation system. You know, they say that the Roman Empire ruled its empire through the terror of rebelling and the horrors of what would happen to you and brutal taxation. That's how they work. And yet Paul is saying, this government is from God. Honor it. Isn't that amazing? You know, if ever there was a passage that emphasized that these are the gifts of God, even when they're not functioning as they should be, well, there it is. Okay, so that's enough theory. I could stop for any questions now, again, if you want. Questions there. One is, how do you apply this? And specifically to Grangetown. Well, that's the next section in the last 10 minutes. So I'm coming to that. Then the other question was just pointing out that, yeah, they're good gifts from God, but they could also be the instruments of evil, couldn't they? So you get, the Roman Empire is a classic example. Here, God uses this sort of government system in the Roman Empire to protect. But there's plenty of examples of the same government persecuting Christians. And that's absolutely right. So there are limits to common grace. And anything can be used for both good and evil. So think of common grace as a restraint. You know, we know that every human being is fallen. And so every human institution is fallen. And that means it's a threat to life and limb, potentially. Think about common grace as being God sort of restraining that. So think about it in your own life, you know. We confess that we are sinners. But none of us is as bad as we might be. Or none of us is as bad as we could be. Because God has put things in our lives that will restrain us. Now we can reject that. Or Satan can get his hooks into us and move us forward. And we can take the gifts of God and use them for evil purposes. That's definitely true. But that's the complexity and chaos of a fallen world. The good gifts of God can be used against him and his people. Satan uses the good gifts of God. I mean, in the garden in Genesis 3, Satan got in there and he used the tree that God had given, a gift of God, and he used it against God. And there would be loads of examples of that. So, yeah, don't hear me say that, you know, salvation comes through good government and salvation comes through great marriage and salvation comes through... That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is these things are important, and I'm saying it's important that they are strong. And I'm about to say it's important that we as Christians are engaged, seeking to strengthen these things. It's not a waste of our time. And God can use these things for good and in his battle against spiritual darkness. Okay, let's go on to the last little section then, and then we're finished. Let's get practical. Now, what does it mean then? If there is such a thing as common grace, and God can use it for his glory, government, friendship, marriage, all these sorts of things, what does that mean? Well, I try to be as practical as I can. So let's think about Grangetown now and answer that question about how does it work out here. So first of all, let's have confidence. As God's people, we see the society around us is not as close to God as it was 50 years ago. Certainly not as close as it was 100 years ago. We live in days when everything is much more secular, and it appears even more secular than it is because the media is more secular than it is. It's possible for us to be intimidated and possible for us to withdraw into our little personal lives and our little chapels and to pull up the drawbridge. Well, common grace is a reminder that this is still God's world and that we mustn't do that. Yes, it's in rebellion, but he's still sovereign over it and he's still committed to it, and he is working in it way beyond the walls of the church. So really, all good comes from him. All truth comes from him. And because of his common grace, you will find some good everywhere. So we must not demonize people. We must not demonize our culture. We must recognize that in any person, there will be something of God's common grace. In any situation, in any system, no matter how fallen and corrupt it may be, unless we find ourselves in unprecedented days, there will be something of God's grace in it. So we can have confidence, not be afraid. Second thing is to recognize the power and the value of all these common grace things. So in Acts 19, as we've seen, Satan is on the brink of a victory. And God stops it through the town clerk, through the legal system, through the rule of law. So yes, God can use common grace in the spiritual battle. So let's recognize then the importance of our politicians, the importance of our police force, the importance of our cultural institutions, the importance of our community centres and local government and the different committees and keep Grangetown tidy things and all the rest of it. Let's recognise those have value and significance and importance. They're part of God's common grace, and they have the potential for God to use them, for them to play a part in the coming of his kingdom. They're not saving things. They don't bring people to faith in Jesus. The same as this city clerk didn't bring anyone to faith in Jesus, but he had a part to play. Well, so around us. Let's also recognize then that the church, us, as a church, we have an important role to play. We have to teach about it. Hence, I'm trying to do that tonight, and there'll be other occasions. But not just teach about it. We need to disciple people for it. You know, usually our discipleship focuses rightly on our Christian lives, doesn't it? What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus? So we want to talk about conversion and sanctification and assurance and guidance and these important spiritual issues. We want to talk about daily prayer and daily Bible reading and doing good works. We want to talk about being a church together and meeting for worship and working together to serve. So we want to do all of that. That's our discipleship. But if that's all we do, do you know what you're doing? You're only discipling people for the evenings and the weekends. Truth is that for most people, most of their time is spent in the workplace. We've got to disciple people for that. What does it mean to be a Christian as a shopkeeper, as a factory worker, as a teacher, as a police officer, as a street sweeper, as a professor? What does it mean to be a Christian in that environment? We need to disciple people to be citizens in their own community, to care about it, even in politics, to understand it and be able to engage with it, and cultural things, to connect all of those things up with God and with creation. And that's important because it invests it all with significance. So, I mean, to be a musician, for example, to have that as a hobby, say, and to be playing music, that has value in and of itself for God's glory, and it has value because it brings pleasure, and it's a beautiful thing, and all the rest of it. So it has importance. Also, though, and this is the big thing the Bible emphasizes, is we've got to be ready to intercede. So this prayer in 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 to 4, it tells us that we must be praying for kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. See, pray for the Roman Empire, says Paul, so that we can have a quiet life and get on with the work of the gospel. See, that's what common grace does. Creates the space, creates the freedoms for gospel work. Okay, so the church has an important role in all of this, but actually, in this realm, it's the individual Christian that is center stage. You see, the main work of the church, as the church, is not common grace, it is saving grace. That's the business we are in. We're the gospel people. We are doing gospel work as the church. So what we do is focused on that. It's the individual believer who moves this forward as they follow their interests and their calling and use their gifts in their neighborhoods and in their workplace. So this is an aspect where the individual believer is actually more frontline than the church as an institution. So really the point we're making is be involved. This is where I'll end. Be involved. You know, your work matters. What you do through the week, it matters, it's significant. Where you live is important. You should love where you live. You should take your citizenship seriously. You should use your hobbies and your interests and your skills and pursue them. Join and form the Facebook groups and the committees and the organizations in Grangetown. Play an active part in that, because it's pleasing to God and because it's part of God's common grace. So what I'm saying, and here I finish, all these things are good. They're not saving. They should never displace our witness, and certainly shouldn't displace the gospel work of the church. But they're good things, and we are seeing in Acts 19 that God can use them. Maybe you and I will never know how God used them, but we can be certain that he will. Okay. Let's just stop. Any final questions? Here or there? Okay, if we kill the mic for a minute.